Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Nantagarthi Vaishnava Vrinda ki jai, Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur ki jai, Pram Shikaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinath Shai Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana ki jai, Vrindavan Dhamma ki jai, Mathura Dhamma ki jai, Navadvipa Mayapur Dhamma ki jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma ki jai, Ganga Maya Jamuna Devi ki jai, Bhakti Devi ki jai, Tulsi Maharani ki jai, Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharne Nirsesa Nirvati Paskatyade Satarne Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha Panchakalpa Chudascha Kipasindhiyavata Parijanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavibhi Namo Namaha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So it's September 16, 2020, from Hilo, Hawaii, over the internet. We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 22, Prithu Maharaj's Meeting with the Four Kumaras, Text 31. Vasyatyanu smritis chitam.
Vasyatyanu smritis chitam.
Jnana brahmsa smritikshaya.
Jnana brahmsa smritikshaya.
Tadrodam kavaya prahur.
Tadrodam kavaya prahur.
Atmapana vamatmana.
Atmapana vamatmana.
Please. Brashyati.
Brashyati.
He comes destroyed.
He comes destroyed.
Anu smritihi.
Anu smritihi.
Constantly thinking. Chittam.
Chittam.
Consciousness.
Consciousness.
Jnana Brahmshaha.
Jnana Brahmshaha.
Bereft of real knowledge.
Bereft of real knowledge.
Smritikshaye.
Smritikshaye.
By destruction of remembrance.
By destruction of remembrance.
Tatrodam.
Tadrodam.
Choking that process.
Choking
that process. Kavayaha.
Kavayaha.
Great learned scholars.
Great learned scholars.
Prahu.
Prahu.
Have opened.
Have opened.
Atma.
Atma.
Of the soul.
Of the soul.
Apanavam.
Apanavam.
Destruction.
Destruction.
Atmanaha.
Atmanaha.
Of the soul.
Of the soul.
I'll need a minute here.
Srila Prabhupada's translation. When one deviates from his original consciousness, he loses the capacity to remember his previous position or recognize his present one. When remembrance is lost, all knowledge acquired is based on a false foundation. When this occurs, learned scholars consider that the soul is lost. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The living entity, or the soul, is ever existing and eternal. It cannot be lost, but learned scholars say it is lost when actual knowledge is not working. That is the difference between animals and human beings. According to less intelligent philosophers, animals have no soul. Due to the animal's gross ignorance, however, it appears that they have lost their souls. Without the soul, a body cannot move. That is the difference between a living body and a dead body. When the soul is out of the body is called dead. The soul is said to be lost when there is no proper knowledge exhibited. Our original consciousness is Krishna consciousness, because we are part and parcel of Krishna. When this consciousness is misguided and one is put into the material atmosphere, which pollutes the original consciousness, one thinks that he is a product of the material elements. Thus one loses his real remembrance of his position as part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, just as a man who sleeps forgets himself. In this way, when the activities of proper consciousness are checked, all the activities of the lost soul are performed on a false basis. At the present moment, human civilization is acting on a false platform of bodily identification. Therefore, it can be said that the people of the present age have lost their souls, and in this respect, they are no better than animals. Brasyat janu smritish chittam gyan abramsa smriti kshaye tad rodham kavaya prahur atma panavam atmanaha. When one deviates from his original consciousness, he loses the capacity to remember his previous position or recognize his present one. When remembrance is lost, all knowledge acquired is based on a false foundation. When this occurs, learned scholars consider that the soul is lost. It's such a very basic point that if the original calculation is wrong, everything based on that original calculation is not going to work. Right? If you start off with a false idea, then everything you get from that point on doesn't work. And you can keep adjusting and adjusting and adjusting and adjusting everything that's piled on top of it. But the foundation's rotten. It doesn't work. I remember we used to run into this a lot when I was teaching kids. And we used to run into it especially with mathematics. So let's say that a child's early mathematics instruction was all by rote memory. Right? They're just memorizing their multiplication tables. They're just memorizing addition facts, memorizing subtraction facts, and they don't really have any conception of what they're doing. At a certain point in their instruction, as they progress, it's like they just can't memorize anymore, and people start having difficulty with mathematics. And it seems to start happening somewhere between 12 and 14 years of age, that students start really struggling. And 99 times out of 100, it was because their initial mathematic instructions was flawed. They didn't understand what they were doing. It was all, 6 times 5 is 30, 7 times 6, it was just like that. There was no understanding. And this, the same holds true with so many things. If the beginning is messed up, then everything else from that point, the foundation of a house, you have the foundation of a house. If it's shaky, it's not right, you start putting on the second floor, the third floor, the fourth floor, and it's going to fall down. When we have relationships that start on a platform of deceit, that start on an inauthentic platform. I mean, sometimes you read about these people who, they pretend they're someone that they're not. Right? I read about this guy once who pretended that he was from a country that he wasn't from, and he even got married and got a job all based on this pretense. And so everything in the relationship was false. It wasn't able to have a real or natural relationship. They could never visit his family, or everything was a mess. And the material life is like that. We're trying to solve our various problems. Every day we have some sort of problem, isn't it? Every day there's something that comes up where it's like, okay, this is a problem. And as soon as we think we've solved all of our problems, then there's another problem and another problem and another problem. And we keep thinking, if I could just solve this problem and that problem, then I would be happy. But the difficulty is in the foundation. The difficulty is in the foundation. And the difficulty here is in identity. is in identity. We don't know who we are. So there's a progression here. And this progression reminds me something of the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, text 62 and 63. Right? I'm sure everybody's familiar with that, that by contemplating the objects of the senses, one develops attachment. From attachment, lust develops. From lust, anger. From anger... Chapter 2, text 62, where there Krishna says that by contemplating the objects of the senses, one develops attachment. From attachment comes lust. From lust comes anger. From anger comes bewilderment of memory. When memory is bewildered, intelligence is lost, and one falls back down into the material pool. So in today's verse and purport, we find a four-step progression. That first, one's real identity gets covered by a false identity. This false identity causes a loss of memory of who we really are. In the present and in the past. Who we are at present, who we were in the past. Then all of our knowledge from that point has a false foundation. Then the real self becomes invisible and we live like an animal. So here we see a very negative picture in this particular verse. And the Shastra is composed of both very positive things. You know, if you do this, you'll get this wonderful result. Krishna is like this. Krishna is like this. The spiritual world is like this. The soul is wonderful. And then we also get this very negative instruction of, you know, if you do this bad thing, this will happen. If you do this bad thing, this will happen. Material life is like this. Material consciousness is like this. And the fact that there's this negative and positive, we were just simply studying the Ishopanishad and Bhakti Shastri, and it reminds me of the Ishopanishad saying that we have to understand both the positive and the negative side by side. We have to understand vidya and avidya. We have to understand sambhutim and asambhutim. So the Shastra gives both. It goes gives the pot, you could say the carrot and the stick. It gives the positive impetus to go forward, the spiritual impetus and the material negative influence also to go forward. That we need to change our identity. So we're going to look today, because the verse is very much in the negative, so we're going to look today at the negative. So as soon as I turn away from Krishna, as soon as I turn away from my identity as a soul, as soon as I deny my eternal identity, I actually forget who I am. And that's necessary. It's Krishna's kindness to give us this kind of amnesia. You know, sometimes you may read about or hear about, actually one time met a person who had amnesia. You know, they just don't know who they are, what their name is, where they live, what they like, anything like that. So Krishna has to give us this amnesia if we want to rebel against him, because our essential nature, Jivera Swarupaya Krishnara Nityadasa, our essential nature is as his servant. It's our nature. It's like it's the nature of my hand to serve my body. It's the nature of the cells in my hand to serve my body. And if I want to forget Krishna, if I want to forget my relationship with him, I have to forget my identity. They're intrinsically connected. I can't remember my own glories as a soul and forget Krishna. It just doesn't work. I mean, the impersonalists try for that. They try to not know about God, to forget about God, and still be absorbed in their spiritual nature. But Avasuddha Buddhya, that's not a pure intelligence. And we find that the impersonalists generally fall down from that position and get involved again in materialistic life. So when I say, Krishna, I don't want to know you, he says, well, then you have to not know yourself either. And we lose this memory, anusmriti. Anusmriti is a very interesting word. Which we'll come back to in a moment, but it's a fascinating word. We have also Right Smritik Shaye, the destruction of being able to remember. Of course, Krishna says, Matasmatir Gyanam Apohanam Cha. He's the source of memory, he's the source of forgetfulness. So even in this forgetfulness, actually Krishna is there. It's his material energy, Daivi Eshaguna Mai, that allows us to forget who I am. And then as soon as I forget who I am, everything I do is wrong. It's just wrong. Because I have to think I'm something. You know, I can't just function with thinking that I'm nothing. But everything's wrong. And we've talked about this a lot because there's a lot of evidence from research in psychology and sociology that every decision that a human being makes is based on their concept of identity. You know, I was just this morning hearing a lecture where Srila Prabhupada was saying that before we do anything, we weigh the pros and cons of it. But we weigh the pros and cons of it in terms of our identity. You have a certain way of thinking of myself. I think, well, you know, I'm a white, elderly, American lady. And then I think, what do white, elderly, American ladies do? What's proper for them? And what's not proper for them? You know, what's a good husband do? What's a good son do? What's a good employer do? What's a good employee do? We have a certain view of ourselves. If you're introspective, you'll notice that this is what's going on. When you're making decisions, you're making decisions based on identity. Like if you're deciding whether or not you want to spend money on something, that goes back to our identity. Am I a thrifty person? Am I an extravagant person? Am I a poor person? Am I a rich person? Am I the kind of person? I was reading today about this man who was worth billions of dollars, and he's now very elderly, and he pledged that he was going to spend the vast majority of his money on charity, which he did. So he always lived super simply. He never used his money for luxuries, and he gave the vast majority, like nearly all of his money, away in charity. So he had an identity. I am a frugal, philanthropic person. And so he would make his decisions based on that. And another person with that amount of money who might have a different identity of, oh, I am a very rich person. I was also reading about the accounts of people who grew up in very rich families where, you know, their parents would give them two cars for their birthday. And if they broke their phone the day they got it, their parents would just buy them a new phone. You know, so they had a different identity. I'm rich and I'm extravagant. And then decisions are made on that basis. Do I buy this thing? Well, am I frugal or am I extravagant? Am I rich? Am I poor? What kind of a person am I? And, you know, what kind of a person am I in terms of my ethnicity, my gender, my age, my family relationship? Then the qualities, am I liberal, am I conservative? Right, well, I'm a conservative, so therefore I have to do this. I was reading about this woman who, she was brought up super conservative, and her whole family was really conservative, and then she became very liberal, and she had a lot of difficulty negotiating her relationship with her husband, with her parents, with her siblings, with her community, because she was expected to act in a particular way. So we have these kind of identities about ourselves, right? I mean, this is when King Rahugana asked Judd Bharat to carry his palanquin. And he was saying, you know, I'm the king. And because I'm the king, I can order you. It's all right for me to order you. And it's mentioned that he wasn't paying his palanquin carriers. They were slaves. So he was thinking, because I'm the king, I'm allowed to just take somebody, take one of my citizens, and press them into service, and have them do whatever I want them to do for me without even offering them any payment. And Judd Bharat said to him, right now, you're the king, and right now, I'm your palanquin carrier. But that may not be a permanent situation, and it's very ironic, because Judd Bharat was a king. Sometimes it said the world, it called Bharat Vash, is named after that, Bharat. He remembered that two lifetimes ago, before he was Jadbharat, the son of a Brahmana, he had been a deer. Before he was a deer, he remembered that he was a king, he was a great emperor. And so he knew I was a king. I had the capacity as a king. Carry my palanquin carrier, whether I pay you or not. And now I'm just some apparently deaf, dumb, mute guy on the side of the road who's young and strong, right? And King Rahuguna was speaking like that to him too. You know, well, I guess you're really old and weak. And that's also part of our identity, you know. I'm young and strong, therefore I can do this and I can't do that. Or I'm old and weak, and therefore I can do this and I can't do that. I was speaking to our devotee, Brajabihari Prabhu, and he was telling me about two devotees he knew very well who were both in their 70s. And one of them would say, 70s is just the beginning. There's still so much I can do for Prabhupada. And the other one was like, you know, I'm already in my 70s. You know, there's not much I can do anymore. So their identity was determining what they could do. And every concept about what's good and what's bad, what's wanted, what's not wanted, what's pleasing, what's not pleasing, is based on this false identity. Srila Prabhupada talks about this in regard to the animals, how to the pig thinks, you know, stool excrement is delicious and it rejects halva, right? Because it has this sense of, I'm a pig, and therefore I like pig food. In fact, it's described in the third canto that when the living entity goes to the hellish planets after death, that a lot of what Yamaraj and his servants are doing is they're conditioning the soul to take a particular body. You know, they're brainwashing them like some kind of, you know, terrible science fiction 1984 book. You know, they're conditioning them. You're a pig. You're a pig. You're a pig. You know, you're a giraffe. You're an asura, you're a human, you're a deva. Oh, that's what I am. You know? And we forget. We forget. And then the real self becomes lost. The real self becomes lost. And even if we're a human, we might as well not be. We might as well be an animal. I mean, an animal with some rare exceptions, like the animals who are devotees of Lord Ramachandra, or the animals who came to see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu when he came to the Jarikhand forest, the animals, of course, in Krishna Lila, and we've had some animals in ISKCON too. There was Shivananda Sen's dog, and we've had animals like that in ISKCON. Jnananda Maharaj made a book about Krishna conscious animals. Right? We had here in Hillsboro, where I'm staying, one devotee joined, Gopal. He joined with his cat, Tom. And Tom didn't act like a cat. He never cleaned himself. He ate prasadam. And he ate prasadam not just directly with his mouth, but he would scoop it with his paw and eat it like he was a human. And he would come to Mangalartik every morning. He would sit outside the door and watch the Mangalartik. And he would come to Bhagavatam class every day, and he would sit outside the window, quietly, the door or the window, quietly. And as soon as the speaker would say any questions, he'd go, meow, meow. So we have these extraordinary animal devotees. But generally speaking, when a soul is in an animal body or a tree body or an insect body, the soul it loses any sense that I exist as a living entity. Right? They're just completely bewildered by the body and mind that they have and the desires of that body and mind. They're basically just controlled by their senses and by what we call instinct. Oh, that's my food, that's not my food. You know, that's my mate, that's not my mate. This is how I live, this is how I build a house. And their ability to exhibit free will is really limited. You know, we see some free will among the animals, but not much. Not much. They're practically operating like machines. And Prabhupada notes this in the purport, how that people will even say animals have no soul. Why do they say that? Because they look at the exhibited activities of animals and they don't see this awareness, this free will that is exhibited in the human form. And so they just say, well, they have no soul. Now, Prabhupada's making the point here, as he makes over and over again, yes, they're a soul. If they're alive, if they're moving, if they're going through the six changes, then that is a soul. But the soul is dead. The soul is lost in the sense that the consciousness is so covered. You know, it's like you have this really thick blanket. You know, you go to some of these Muslim countries where the women are covered head to toe. I mean, literally. It's just, some of them have a veil over their face. It's all black, and the part over their eyes is like a little screen, so they can sort of kind of look through it in a limited way and get around a little bit. But they're just like this walking black blob. And it's like their form is gone. That's the intention, of course, is that their form will be gone. And we understand the reason why they do this. But in any case, the thing is that the covering is so dense that you can't even really tell, you know, who's under there, what's under there, what is the nature of the being that's under this thing. So it's like that with the covering of the animals, that the real nature of the soul or in a plant. I mean, there's some indication. Many decades ago, I remember we took our kids to a pet store, like an easy, cheap zoo. We stopped by, and they were looking at the little animals. And while they were looking at the hamsters and the fish and everything, I picked up one book about hermit crabs. And the book about hermit crabs, the author was saying how hermit crabs have individual personalities. You know, that some hermit crabs, when they see an obstacle, will go over it. Some will just stop. Some will go around it. And they were consistent. He said that he had these pet hermit crabs and they had displayed consistent personality traits. So we do see some aspects of personality in animals, even very low animals, but not much. So when human beings completely forget their identity, then the activity of human beings becomes very animalistic. Now, you might say, well, human beings still exhibit a lot more personality than animals do, and we hold human beings accountable, that's why we have the justice system. Yes, but as Srila Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavad Gita, that people are just controlled by the modes that they're attracted to. They're practically like puppets. We had that old BBT picture of there's Krishna blowing his flute, and there's Maya Devi as Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas with strings manipulating living beings who are controlled by these modes. And this is the reason why, as Krishna explains to Arjuna, that human beings who've forgotten who they are end up doing things that they don't even want to do. Like, why did I do that? Why did I eat the extra piece of cake? Why did I yell at my child? You know? Why did I spend all night watching movies and now I can't get up in the morning? I mean, people over and over again end up doing things that they don't even want to do because they're under the control of the modes, they're under the control of their identity, their false identity, and they've completely forgotten their real identity. So, although this particular verse is not talking about a cure, it's not talking about the positive, it's only talking about the negative, and so in that sense, taking verses like this out of context is rather depressing. At the same time, there's some indication here, indirectly, about what is the hope. And we have particularly this word, anusmritihi. And I really like this word, anusmritihi. So smritihi means to remember. And anu means to follow. When you have anusmriti, it means you're remembering over and over again. We use a word in English often, churning. Like you think of churning butter, and you're moving the cream over and over and over and over and over again until it becomes solid into butter. We also use a word in English called mulling. So if you're going to mull something, like sometimes we take apple juice, we heat it up and we put things like cinnamon and cloves and allspice in it, and we cook the apple juice with these spices. And then we call it mulled apple cider because it has the flavor of the spices has permeated the apple juice. Right, or you can cook, there's a nice recipe Korma has for vegetable soup. It's beans and vegetables. And you just cook these herbs into the soup for like an hour, and the flavor of the herbs permeates the soup. So anusmriti is like that. When we're mulling something, we're thinking about something over and over and over again. Right? What Krishna's talking about, contemplating. So whatever we think about over and over again is anusmriti. Now, it's interesting that in the 10th canto, when Bhima and Duryodhan are fighting, they are both described with this anusmriti, that they're remembering over and over and over again how the other person has insulted them and how the other person has offended them. And because of that, when Balaram comes to give them good advice, they don't pay any attention. That's in the negative sense. In the positive sense, anusmriti is when we're mulling over Krishna. So what happens when we remember Krishna? We remember Krishna's name, form, qualities, pastimes, philosophy, over and over and over again. We're churning in our thoughts and we're mulling. The spices of Krishna start to permeate our consciousness. We have this chitta, anusmriti, chitta. They're permeating our consciousness. What happens is it starts to revive our memory. Now, we can have on an intellectual platform, I know that I'm not this body, I know that I'm a soul, I know that I have nothing to do with this world. But until our actual memory starts to be revived, starts to be rekindled, starts to be reawakened, oh, I'm a servant of Krishna. I have some service to do in relationship to Krishna. Then we can't really act on a real platform consistently. You know, when it's just theoretical, yes, all right, it says this in the Shastra, then we can say, all right, my guru's directed me in this way, so I can follow the instructions of my guru and I can act in this way. But it's not deep, isn't it? And we see that. We see if it's just external, that again and again and again, we're going to fall into this forgetfulness. And again, we're going to act according to the modes of nature. And again, we're going to act according to, we're studying nectar instruction now in Bhakti Shastri, Vachogvegam, Manasakrodavegam, Jivavegam, Udurapastavegam. We're going to be acting according to all those pushings from the false identity. But once we've mulled, once we've done this anusmriti of the spiritual enough, and we start to remember, like an amnesiac who starts to remember, oh, I'm actually John Smith, and my wife is Betty, and I'm a, you know, lawyer downtown. Once we start to remember our identity, then our actions start to be on the spiritual platform. I mean, until that point, we're very much dependent on just following the instructions of Shastra and Guru out of intellectual conviction, which, you know, frankly, may not work all the time, because sometimes our material identity sort of pushes through and we're forced by the modes that we're attracted to. But once our anusmriti, once our remembrance starts to uncover the chetam dharpana marjanam, once it starts to uncover this mirror where we look in the mirror and go, oh, that's who I am, then we have something that's extremely solid. So this question of how we identify and what we remember and what we mull over, what do we do with our mind, what we do with our consciousness, is the essence of any practice of yoga. In karma yoga, you're doing karma, but with a different consciousness. You're doing karma with a consciousness of detachment. In gyan yoga, you're looking at everything from a philosophical point of view. You're constantly analyzing and inquiring from a philosophical point of view about everything. In Jnana Yoga, you're taking your mind and making it still and focused on the Paramatma. And in Bhakti Yoga, one is absorbing one's mind, Maya Shakamana Parta, one is absorbing one's mind in thought of Krishna. So, and of course, one's doing that also through the activities of Bhakti Yoga. If I'm cooking for the deities, if I'm dressing the deities, if I'm working for the Lord, then naturally that's going to push my consciousness. So if we do that, we start to change our identity. And once we start to change our identity, everything starts shifting to align. And then we find that we don't have any problems. That even if we apparently have problems, we actually don't have any problems. So I'll stop there. Yamadutas have a certain kind of enjoyment in hell. You know, there are people right now who are really preparing to be Yamadutas. You know, any vigilante who goes around like, you know, I want to make those evil people suffer in the world, they're preparing to be a Yamaduta. The people who go around trying to be the moral police in the world and try to be really big and scary and, you know, I mean, if you're acting as a proper Kshatriya, that's another thing, and you're going to go to heaven. But if you try to be the moral police person for the world... Yep. Then you can be prepared to be a big, ugly, scary Yamaduta. So they're having a kind of fun. They're having a kind of, they're enjoying the rasa of horror.
I think, Ramananda, I found a verse that you may be referring to. It's in the purport. It says that, for example, if a man is to be punished to remain in hell and eat stolen urine, then first he practices such habits on the planet of Yamaraj, and then is given a particular type of body, that of a hog, so he can eat stolen, think that he's enjoying life. It is stated previously that in any hellish condition, the conditioned soul thinks he's happy. Otherwise, it would not be possible for him to suffer hellish life. So that's always... Maybe you could comment on it, because it's always a little peculiar. It says, otherwise it would not be possible for him to suffer hellish life if he didn't think he was happy. So how do you rectify that idea? This is, by the way, it's from the Bhagavatam. It's 3:30:29, the verse.
3:30:29?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Let's take a look at that. Three.
I'm going to have to mute some of you.
30:29. Aha, uh-huh. This is the chapter about hell. Okay, but I don't understand this as referring to the time in hell being punished. So Srila Prabhupada would talk about, for example, the time that Indra became a pig. So this is a conditioning in the hellish planets, so that when you take birth as a pig, you'll think you're happy. But the actual situation in hell, I don't see as being enjoyable.
Sense.
You know, that wouldn't fit with the other descriptions of hell in the fifth canto and so forth. But it's that one is trained to think, yes. I mean, there was was the author. I can't remember, it was a book I read when I was a teenager about this former black slave in America who had worked hard to free the slaves, but he had worked he had done like violent uprisings. Anyway, he was at one point captured and put into jail, and in the jail they were passing stolen urine into a bucket, and he was seeing that there were flies in the bucket eating the stolen urine, and he was thinking, those flies are thinking that they're happy, but from an objective point of view, they're in a terrible situation. And he compared that to some people in slavery who were like, you know, well, I've got a decent master and I don't want to, you know, risk getting captured, so I think I'm just going to stay where I am. I don't want to rebel. And he said they may think they're happy, but from an objective point of view, they're suffering. So I think it's like that if, you know, the mantra of the demons in the Bhagavad Gita is Ishwara Hama Humbo Gisita Hum. I am Sukhi. I am happy. I am perfect, powerful, and happy. You know, we see, like Hiranyakashipu saying, I'm happy, and then he's always drunk and he's always yelling at people. You know, like our current American president doesn't strike me as a very happy person. You know, he very rarely looks happy. In fact, I can't even think of any time where he looked happy. And he's, you know, always insulting people and yelling at people and criticizing people. But I'm sure if you said to him, you know, are you happy? He'd say, oh, I'm happy. I'm perfect, powerful, and happy. I have everything that I want. And materialistic people are like this. You know, yes, I am happy. They don't have much in their life that could be called joy. But they're thinking like that, that I'm happy. So they're really in a terrible situation of suffering. So the animals are also like that. And unless they're conditioned, unless a person's conditioned to that, they wouldn't accept it. So Yamaraj is conditioning the living entity who has worked for a particular kind of body and in one sense desired a particular kind of body and has the karma for a particular body to be able to live in that body, to be able to function in that body. I mean, that's true for us here on this planet as humans also. You know, our facility on the Earth planet in Kali Yuga as humans is pretty bad compared to our real spiritual situation. We're naturally very, very powerful beings with great, you know, we have great abilities. Our senses are amazing, our spiritual senses, our spiritual mind, our capacity, I mean, and we're so restricted, but we're thinking, oh yeah, everything's cool. You know, everything's fine. I'm happy. Yeah. I mean, we should be happy, but we should be happy spiritually. You know, it's not that we should go like, oh, actually, I'm miserable. I'm suffering in this world. I'm just suffering in this world. It's not like that. But, you know, we're thinking, oh, I'm happy because the sun is shining, and I'm happy because I have enough money in the bank. And, I mean, it's nice to be grateful. Not that we should be ungrateful. But we're meant for a different kind of spiritual happiness. And we're also conditioned to think, well, this is as good as it gets, and I'm happy with it. Is that all right?
Hare Krishna, Urmila Das, Devi, thank you for the class. Concerning what you are saying, don't you think that that is because maybe happiness has to do with the concept that people think that the truth is relative instead of absolute, out of the... You know, in the conversation, in the critic of Socrates by Prabhupada, Socrates was saying that the truth is absolute, and Prabhupada agreed, said, yes, the truth is absolute, but usually people think that the truth is relative. Don't you think that people think that that happiness is relative instead of absolute?
Yeah, that's a very good way to explain it. As soon as I have a materialistic identity, I'm going to think of happiness in a relative way, and I'm going to be satisfied with that, with relative happiness. I'm not really going to be satisfied. You know, in materialistic identity, no one is really satisfied. But I'm going to be able to kind of talk myself into it. Yes, exactly. That is a different angle of vision on the same thing, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else?
I got one more thing. When you were reading the verse, I kept thinking of 1858 Bhagavad Gita and wondering if this is like an expansion on that verse. It says, if you become conscious of me, you'll cross over all the obstacles of conditional life by my grace. If, however, you do not work in such consciousness but act through the false ego, not hearing me,
then you will
be lost.
Yes.
So, It seems like it's the lost is both places. And
yes, this concept of being lost. Of course, this particular verse in the 18th chapter it's interesting about the context of that verse in the 18th chapter. So this is where Krishna has gone back to summarizing what he said in the 3rd chapter about working according to your nature. And where he starts off by telling Arjuna, you're going to work according to your nature, whether you like it or not. You're not going to be able to repress your nature. And your choices are that you can either work according to your nature for my sake, or you can work according to your nature in illusion. So, although it's coming from a very similar position, that if we have our consciousness right, everything's auspicious. Even the so-called difficulties are auspicious, and if we don't have our consciousness right, we're lost, even if we appear to be very materially successful. So, yes, it's a very similar point, but the context of this verse in the 18th chapter is quite fascinating and relates to whether or not Arjuna should fight. You know, Arjuna, should I fight or should I go out begging? And the concept that, Arjuna, you're going to fight anyway. You're going to be a warrior anyway. Like we saw when the Pandavas were in their first exile, when they had left the house of Lak, and Bhima fought with Bakasura anyway, you know, and he fought with Hidimba and so forth and so on. So it wasn't that just because they were dressed as brahmanas and externally living as brahmanas that they really acted as brahmanas. They had the nature to act as warriors. So it's related to a little different topic, but the overall philosophy, yes, is very similar. So I think we should end here. Thank you for tolerating my internet problems, the company working on it, and yesterday I was offline for practically all day. So thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna.